thank you, Connie. It's beautiful. And I loved being here as well. And loved going back to the basics. As Connie said, this month, probably like this week, was when I signed my first letter of call 20 years ago. My first talk at the church was on Halloween. So 20 years ago on Halloween. So
that's
spooky. That's okay, so people talk back while I'm doing this. I was really happy to reconnect with this little book. It's called Can We Talk to God? And it was written, well, it wasn't, it was actually a series of lectures that Dr. Ernest Holmes, the founder of our philosophy, did. And I was thinking about it because I realized that it says in here that it used to be the Ebel lectures. It was the Ebel lectures on spiritual science. And I remember when I read that, I was like, oh, wow, I remember when I was in ministerial school, it was out of print. It was first printed in 1934. And we had a photocopied version of it that got passed down from teacher to student, teacher to student. And I think I probably still have that photocopied copy of the Ebel lectures from all those years ago. And it made me think, and now with the internet, you can really explore some of these things. And I thought, you know, I wonder what, I want to think a little bit more about what this was, the Ebel lectures. I remembered it was a theater in L.A. It was the Wilshire Ebel Theater. So I looked it up. I thought, well, what the heck was this, and what was he doing? And it was a beautiful theater. I mean, it's a landmark historic event. But back then, it was pretty new. It had only been built for about 5 years, and it was very elaborate and ornate. And it was founded by the Ebel Women's Club. And if this was a man, his last name was Ebel, or Ebel, I don't know how you say it, but E-B-E-L-L. We always said Ebel, but it might have been Ebel. Ebel, that's my southern accent there, Ebel. So, but it was a club for women, and I looked it up, and it shows what the purpose was, and I love this. I mean, this is back at the turn of the century. It was like 1894 when they started this. So you have to think about where they were, and it says that the purpose of the Women's Club, the Ebel Women's Club, was to interest women in the study of all branches of literature, art, and science, and the advancement of women in every branch of culture. And their motto was, I will find a way or make one, I serve. And so, you know, this is kind of an amazing thing that this is the turn of the century. And they, in this theater that they built, housed lots of famous people. And it was actually where Judy Garland was discovered when she was a young girl. And it was where Amelia Earhart gave her last talk before she went on her last trip around the world. So this is, and it holds 1,300 people. So this isn't, when you think about Ernest Holmes giving the Ebel lectures, you know, from this little photocopied thing, I'm kind of thinking of a setting like this, you know, everyone's kind of gathered around and talking. He was talking to 1,000 people. I mean, this was a place that wasn't just rented out to nobody. I mean, this was a place that big names came. And back in 1934, Ernest Holmes was a big name. And he was a big name because he was talking mind-blowing stuff. I mean, he was a revolutionary in many ways when it came to religious ideas and religious thoughts. And so these people were coming to hear him, and this was a series of lectures, several lectures. And so they edited them, and sometimes it's hard to read Ernest Holmes because a lot of the talks are from his extemporaneous talking, and I know that when I extemporaneously talk, it needs to be edited. That's my husband would probably... So this is kind of the setting for these talks. And in his talks, he really shares a lot of different ideas. He's coming from a really interesting place. I mean, he talks about Brother Lawrence who was the Carmelite monk in the 1600s. He wrote a book called Practicing the Presence, and it was about washing dishes and about, you know, not being able to touch anything without being able to see the divine presence in this blade of grass. I mean, he talked about that. And he mentions in this book, again, another wonderful thing about the internet is that he mentions in here someone named Dean Ng. Did you notice that, Connie? You read that? Where he says, Dean Ng says, and I'm like, who the heck is Dean Ng? I've never heard of that. And so I looked him up, and there's a whole Wikipedia page about Dean Ng. His name was William Ralph Ng. I don't know if it's Ng or Inge. I don't know. It's I-N-G-E. I don't know, Ng. And he was a contemporary of Ernest Holmes. I mean, he died in 1954. Dr. Ernest Holmes died in 1960. And so this is a contemporary speaker, and he wrote like 35 books, and he was really like the cutting edge during this time. He was a priest, an Anglican priest, and a professor of divinity at Cambridge, and the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, thus the name Dean Ng. And he talked about Christian mysticism. And he was kind of rebellious against the organized structure. He was very critical of the Catholic Church at that time. And he says that he was a strong proponent for a spiritual type of religion, that autonomous faith, which rests upon experience and individual inspiration, as opposed to one of coercive authority. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? No, that's that rest upon experience and individual inspiration. I mean, it's about, you know, so he's talking about Christian mysticism and about where God is and taking our authority, our power back from these institutions who have, you know, created it. And then in this 1934, remember, Dr. Ernest Holmes, he talks about evolution. In this book, in these talks, he talks about evolution. And he says, the evolutionist reads the history of cosmic activities on this planet as he deciphers the unfolding of an intelligent life force carrying creation forward to its consummate point here, which is the production of a self-conscious life. So Dr. Ernest Holmes was talking about self-conscious evolution back in 1934. I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Very
amazing. I just read this, I'm like, wow, this is just like amazing stuff. And that is really where we are right now, right? Evolution is a kind of a big catchphrase. There's a lot of people talking about either denying evolution, but but also the conscious evolution. There are people who talk about the fact that this is the first time in history that we are actually in control of our own evolution. And we're the only species that is aware that we're evolving. Mm-hmm. So we have an awareness of we're evolving, and we have this power to direct where that evolution is going. I mean, that's a pretty big thing, and that's a big responsibility, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How do we evolve? What are we doing to evolve in a way that brings about those things that we talk so much about in our philosophy, the joy, the abundance, the health, the beauty, things like that. So this is the backdrop, and this is what Ernest Holmes was talking about. And I was thinking this whole idea of evolving. And my exploration most recently is about religious science, which is a philosophy that I've practiced and studied and taught for 30 years, is how are we evolving as religious scientists? How do we take these words of Dr. Ernest Holmes and evolve them? I mean, I often think, if Ernest Holmes was alive today, would he be quoting Ernest Holmes? You know, like, I mean, he probably would in some ways, but it wouldn't be a stagnant, like, this is what we, it would be, this is where we came from. These are the foundations, and these are the new people. These are the new Dean Ngs in our world. These are the new people that are studying and exploring new ideas. And so I think, where are we going? And I think about my own evolution in religious science and about how it is mind-blowing. Connie knows this, several people know this, but when I discovered religious science. I actually, my parents had taken me, my mother had taken me to religious science church when I was a teenager, and I kind of, you know, didn't pay much attention to it. And it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that I walked into a religious science church and I saw a woman minister. And I had no idea that you could be a woman and a minister. This was like a whole, and my mind was blown, and my whole life changed in that moment. Because the potential, the possibility that I did not know exists, which was there all along, all of a sudden opened up to me. And I went, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. And I started and I just went for it. And that's what religious science gives us, doesn't it? It gives us this potential of evolving to something new, of opening ourselves up to something new. So I think about what Dr. Ernest Holmes was doing. What was that mind-blowing thing for him? And how was, and he was talking to this group of, you know, women didn't get the vote until 1920. This women's club started in 1894. So 25 years before. He was speaking a mere 14 years at the Ebell Theater, 14 years after women got the vote. Religious science and his work opened doors to women, opened doors to women, to being empowered. You know, when I was in my early 20s and the first time I went to Asilomar, which was our summer gathering, I saw, we used to have dances back then afterwards, and religious scientists are good partiers. They throw a good party. And I was, you know, having a great time, and I noticed that a gay couple, two young men, were dancing. They were dancing together, and they were holding each other's hands, and they were looking in each other's eyes, and everybody, you know, was just having a good old time. And I was so struck by that, because it was like, wow, you know, what would it be like if I couldn't do that? You know, that if I couldn't, if I was in love and happy that I couldn't show that in public, and I couldn't dance, and I was just so in awe that this philosophy, this organization, created this space for people to be who they are and to be loved for who they are. And this was, you know, in the early 80s. And look how far we've come. And so religious science for me and for many people opened these doors, you know, said, wait a minute, we can have respect and honor people for whoever they are, whether they're a woman or whether they're gay or whether they're a man or whether, you know, whatever it is. And so we've always been on this cutting edge of helping people expand their consciousness about what is true and what is right. And so as I continue to think about this, I thought, you know, what was Ernest Holmes' big edge? And I was reading a book, by a lady by the name of Anadea Judith. She's written several books, but one of the books that she's written recently is called The Global Heart Awakens. And she kind of is talking about our evolution. And she talks about the evolution from kind of a child consciousness to an adolescent consciousness to an adult consciousness. And Ernest Holmes was talking, he was moving the consciousness around spirituality, about how we're empowered, our individuality, from this child consciousness, which is that God is a father up in the sky out there, and that he is telling us what to do and how to be good. I mean, it's a real parental relationship, right? So what he was doing in those eval lectures was saying, no, we are not children anymore. We are powerful. We don't need we can talk to God. We don't need a middleman. Sorry, Jesus. As like in the song, you know, you needed an operator in Jesus. Now we've got cell phones and it's on speed dial now, you know. We have Facebook and Twitter and all kinds of ways to connect with the divine. We don't need that. That was a radical thought. And that evolution of being an adolescent, that so it's moving, like from child to adolescent to being a teenager. We have a teenager right now. And there's, so when you get into that state, I mean, it's like this new state of empowerment. No, I don't need anybody. I can do it all myself. The world is my, you know, playground. The refrigerator is always full. You know, I can go in and eat whatever I want. I can, you know, I don't need these adults. I don't need these adults. I'm in this adolescent place. And I think Ernest Holmes did that so beautifully, moved us from that child state of how we're going to think about God and how we're going to think about ourselves and how do we create and who's in power, to this adolescent state of, oh, I'm in power. You know, Ernest Holmes said, there's a power in the universe greater than we are, and we can use it. You know, we can use it, man. I mean, we can take hold of it and be in charge of it. That's a really empowering place, very empowering. And yet, you don't stay an adolescent forever. You know, that hopefully that teenager who's eating you out of house and home in the middle of the night and living in your basement eventually grows up, eventually says, oh, wait, I'm not the only person here. I'm not the only one. Yeah, I'm empowered, but adults realize they're in community. Adults realize that maybe I need to be able to fill the refrigerator, or I need to be aware of what I'm using or consuming. You know, we start looking, and I think that's where we are. That's the evolution now, is moving from that adolescent stage, which has served us so well, you know. And if you're new to religious science, and you may not, it may not be as aware to you, In my experience of religious science throughout all the years, it has always been in this kind of adolescent state of we can have whatever we want, anytime we want, and it's a powerful place and it's a good place. And so for me, my evolution in this process is kind of moving from that place of take, me, to, oh, I'm an adult in this relationship. I'm wanting to reach out and to help and to give and to be aware. So the process of that, it's like the philosophy, the foundation is the same. The application is different. So Dr. Ernest Holmes said, the purpose of religious science is to heal the illusion of separation between God and man. Now, he said that back then. So we would say God and humankind. I would say to heal the illusion of separation, period. Because it's not just about we started out. Our evolution was healing the illusion of separation between our bodies and ourselves. I mean, our founders all healed, except for Ernest Holmes, actually. The founders of New Thought all healed some physical ailment. That was what brought them into this idea of how can I heal myself? And they realize that the way you heal yourself is to heal that illusion of separation between God and myself, so which takes a whole study, a practice of changing our idea of God. I mean, how can you heal the illusion of separation from it unless you change what you think of it? That's the whole practice. That is the whole practice. That is the unity, that, you know, of the individual and God. First two steps with our spiritual mind treatment, that God is all there is and we're a part of it. All the other stuff is just to keep us in church every Sunday. And No. But that's the practice. Hafiz said, I love this, Hafiz said, just sit there now. Don't do a thing. Just rest. For your separation from God is the hardest work in the world. Separation from God is the hardest work in the world. So our practice in religious science is to heal that illusion of separation so that it becomes easier because we're not pushing against. We're not pushing against. So Anodea Judith has this wonderful visualization or visual. She talks about the chakra systems. She's talking about the evolution from this child to this adolescent to this adult. And she says that in the West, we have moved from the root chakra into the solar plexus. It's all about power, you know. There's a power in the universe greater, and we can use it. I mean, there's this real power place. And then in the East, It's come from the top to the head, the thoughts, the thinking, the you know, analyzing, the that it's, you know, it's all about up here. And so the energy is moving, the energy from our root through our solar plexus and our head through our heart and through our throat and out our heart. That this is where we are. We're evolving to this place of moving out from our heart. And that's the global heart, the global heart awakening, moving that. So this is kind of where we are. And that process of evolving through our history of religious science has been about healing the illusion of separation between ourselves and our bodies. And then that moves into, of course, what do we think about God? Healing the illusion of the divine through us. And now it's moving into healing the illusion of separation between us and our neighbors, us and the world, us and the earth. And how do we do that? How do we move from this contemplative place to this place of action? Sometimes in religious science, we can kind of get into this place of, well, when do we act? Because if we act, then that means that we're claiming the negative stuff, that we're putting energy into that which is bad, and we don't want to ever go there. We want to stay positive. So how do I act but stay in this place? James Dillett Freeman told this joke. He's a poet laureate for Unity, which is another New Thought philosophy, and he'd said that these three men were fishing in a small boat on a lake when a storm arose, and the winds rocked the boat, and the waves were washing over the side, and the boat began to take in water. And so one of the first man said, "Oh, we better pray." And the other man said, "No, we need to bail." And the other one said, "Let us pray, but let us bail while we pray." And that's where we are. That's where we are. I truly believe that that's where we are in evolving, that our prayer is so important, our aligning with the divine, coming from that place of oneness. And yet, we got to start bailing. You know, we have some things that need to change in our actions, in our habits, and how we see the world. And so I've actually coined this phrase, and it's my favorite phrase that I've been exploring. And it's like, well, if we become activists, because activism is, you know, kind of a no-no word in our philosophy sometimes, that, you know, you're coming from, we're for something and against nothing, and we have all these kinds of things. But I thought, well, what are we activists for? And I thought, you know, we're activists for oneness. So we can have oneness activism. We can be oneness activists. And we can come from that place of oneness while we active. And you think about how that would change what we do. One of my favorite leading edge people that I love so much is Joanna Macy. She is a Buddhist scholar, and she has been on the front lines of activism, of spiritual activism, in the nuclear proliferation, and now she works a lot in global warming and a lot in environmental issues. And she shares three dimensions of activism. And so I think about her three dimensions of activism and how we can do that from a place of oneness activism, of spiritual truth of who we are. It's inspiring to me. So she talks about, I'm going to try to speed this up because I've been talking too much. I'm going.
You could go on forever. I'm so deprived of your
comments. So I have coined this phrase, spiritual activism. And my catchphrase, the vision that I have, the purpose of that is acting as if our inherent oneness with life and our planet and each other matters. Acting as if our oneness matters. That's the evolution. And so when we act, of course, there has to be action involved with that. So Joanna Macy talks about these three dimensions of action. And the first one is to stop the damage. You know, these are the activists that go out, you know, Julie Butterfly Hill, who goes and climbs up in the tree, says, you know, you're not going to cut this tree down. the young men who sat at the lunch counter in Greensboro, is it North or South Carolina? One of the Carolinas. The Woolworth lunch, what? South Carolina, yeah. The Woolworth lunch counter. They were fighting for oneness. What is that? Segregation, separation? They were these oneness activists sitting at this counter saying, no, we have to stop this. We have to stop this. When we do this with our bodies, it's something happens to our bodies and we're physical forms. And we realize that, and I know this has been for me, when I become more one with my body, when I become more with this temple, I treat it better. I stop the activities that have created challenge and ill health and physical harm to my body. So this is the stop the action. And this was the quote from this book that kind of inspired this whole thing for me. It was from, you know, from the book by Ernest Holmes. The furtherance of evolution depends upon our ability to sense a unity with nature and her forces. When the knowledge of this unity comes alike to all people, the tread of armies will cease, and the bugle call will echo the soft notes of brotherly love. It says, in mental and spiritual healing, the supremely important thing to emphasize is the presence of good and its perfect unity within the individual. So he's talking about activism here. He's talking about when you get it, things will change. But we have to change. We have to be a part of that. We can't just think about it. We have to actively change in what we do. And so this stopping the damage, especially when it comes to our environment, to our world, it's about connecting, about acting as if our oneness with our world matters. And I ran across this. This is Ernest Holmes wrote this. And I had never heard this before. I don't know if you've heard it, Connie, but it's so different than what I've thought of as Dr. Ernest Holmes, but it's so beautiful. And he writes this about connecting with our world. He says, I listened one day to a little brook as it went singing along. It babbled to me of cool spots and of shady nooks away from the haunts of others. I followed my little friend to a place where sweet-scented ferns and grass, shaded by the trees, whispered thoughts of peace to me. I lay flat on the ground and listened to the voice of nature. I slept, and in my sleep a vision came. I was shown that all nature is alive and filled with one presence. I beheld in the brook the laughter of God, in the overhanging branches the protection of the infinite, in the waving grass and ferns the whisperings of God's love. I sensed in this atmosphere the vitality of life, and the sun reflected in the little stream covered all with a golden glow. I woke refreshed and renewed in my mind and body, and I went again into the places where people live, mm-hmm. confident and happy. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, I think that's just so inspirational. It's from a Holmes reader. It's called Holmes Readers for the Seasons. It was compiled by Carol Sheffield, Ministry of Prayer. That's not something we hear, Dr. Ernest Holmes, but that talk speaks to that very thing. That, you know, he connected. He knew that the divine was moving through that sense of nature, and it uplifted him and allowed him to go out into the world. And so as religious scientists, or as, for me, as a minister, it's almost an imperative for me to help people connect more deeply with nature, with the earth. And when we do that, we understand our oneness and we act as if it matters. We begin to make changes in our lifestyle. We begin to honor our world and our earth in a way that maybe we wouldn't if we were unconscious to that oneness. This is oneness activism in process. So the second way, the second level of activism, according to Joanna Macy, is changing the structures of the system. So when those young men sat at the Greensboro Woolworths counter, that was stopping negative behavior, or the separation. But what had to happen then is like, well, what's perpetuating it, and the civil rights laws, and how do we, all that had to happen. We had to change our whole structure, and there was so much, there was a lot. I mean, we thought we just went through it with our with the government, but back then, I mean, it was a very divisive kind of thing. So there has to be structural changes. And one of my my current, again, inspirations right now for this type of thing is, her name is Claire Dakin. And she said this about stewardship. She said, to have awakened sense of responsibility at a felt level, Dr. Ernest Holmes is talking about, if we moved from disconnection to connection, we couldn't harm our earth. Collective work toward a healthy ecosystem, our health would be reflective of that abundance. Our interconnectedness to the living world and the nature brings a desire to protect it. And she started an organization called Tree Sisters, treesisters.org. And her whole thought is getting 100,000 women to, she's talking to the feminine nature, but it's not just women, but her inspiration is that to have 100,000 women each give $15 a month to be able to plant 24 million trees in India in a single year. She wants to create a sense of normalcy of us contributing to our breathing, to the air that we breathe. And she had a wonderful vision, which I can tell you about later, but I won't go into it as much because of our time limit. But treesisters.org, if you want to hear about her vision and who she is and how she's working. But this is this changing the structure, beginning to change the structure. We've seen it in civil marriage and gay rights. I mean, it wasn't just about stopping that, but it's about changing the legal system. And look at how fast that's happening, how fast that is evolving as the consciousness changes. So Dr. Ernest Holmes said, the whole aim, and this plays into this third level of activism, and it's the one that we're most familiar with, most comfortable with. It's the shift in consciousness. So we have stopping the behavior, changing the structure, shift in consciousness. And I love this vision. Dr. Ernest Holmes says, the whole aim of the study of the science of mind is to realize and consciously penetrate the upper atmospheres of our thought and bring down, as if it were, into the lower mind, greater visions of reality. To reach into that higher state of consciousness, not something out there, but within ourselves, and bring it down into a vision of what our reality can look like. That's the most powerful prayer process we can do. And Sri Aurobindo said, who was Ernest Holmes studied, they didn't talk about it that much because he was Hindu, and I think they weren't sure how that would go over with the Christian audience that he was talking to at the time. But Sri Aurobindo was of great influence, and he said, there is an evolution of the consciousness behind the evolution of the species, and the spiritual evolution must end in a realization, individual and collective, on the earth. So the changing of our consciousness. And when you think about that, we have a changed consciousness about women in the ministry, in working. We have a changed consciousness about people of color. We have a changed consciousness about lots of different things through the years. And so this is where we are, another change of consciousness. And I think of one of the persons who embodies all of this is like Nelson Mandela. He embodied all of those levels of activism. He helped stop apartheid. He changed the structure, became president of South Africa, and don't you know, he changed the consciousness from consciousness of fear to a consciousness of love, of acceptance, from separation. So there's a man named Tim DeChristopher, and he is an activist. And he, a few years ago, he sat in a room in Utah bidding against the drilling of oil on sacred lands. And he got arrested for doing that because he was disrupting a federal bidding. I mean, and because he didn't really have an intention of buying, but he was trying to delay, and he got arrested. He spent like 2 years in jail. And during that time, President Obama came into office and stopped the drilling. So he stopped the damage in order for new structures to be in place. And he was on Bill Moyers a few weeks ago. He's gotten out of jail. He was talking about activism. And Bill Moyers said, "What do you plan to do now with your life? And are you going to go back out there and be an activist?" And, you know, he talked about the importance of that, but he said, "I'm going to Harvard Divinity School and become a Unitarian Universalist minister." Because he said, ultimately, it's how we treat each other. Ultimately, it's about love. He said, the crisis in Darfur wasn't the lack of water. It was how people treated each other in that process. The shift of consciousness is seeing our brothers and our sisters and our friends as one so that we treat them differently. The change of consciousness. And so that brings it back around to Dr. Ernest Holmes and thinking, you know, he was a oneness activist, wasn't he? He stopped the damage. He started inviting people that usually weren't invited into the process. He told people, don't go to those churches that treat you badly and tell you you're worms of the earth. Don't think you can't talk to God. I mean, he stopped the damage of separation between us and the divine. He created a new structure. He created a new spiritual structure. He helped us learn how to create new structures in our life. And he shifted our consciousness. He shifted our consciousness. So we have a great history for coming from this place of oneness in order to change our world in a way that is authentic and in complete accord with what Dr. Ernest Holmes would teach. And that Bill Moyers was sharing about President's Day. And he was saying that Jefferson, here we celebrate Jefferson, and here he wrote, you know, he wrote, all men are created equal. And yet he had slaves till the day he died. His children were slaves until he died. He sold, when he died, his slaves were sold except for his children. He gave freedom to his children with Sally Hemings, but all his other slaves were sold. So he had this vision. He knew what was right, and yet he couldn't quite do it. And Bill Moyers said this, and I think this is a fitting way to end this. He said, and that's how Jefferson came to embody the oldest and longest war of all, the war between the self and the truth, between what we know and how we live. Our philosophy tells us what we should know, helps us deepen into that, and then it's our job to live it, to act as if our oneness with each other, ourselves, and the earth matters. Thank you. You know, Ernest Holmes died in 1960, and he died a few months before that sit-in in Greenboro. He died 2 years before Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, came out, which was the start of the environmental movement. He died 9 years before any of us saw a picture of the Earth from Apollo. He never saw that picture. So when we talk about moving from this place of adolescence into adulthood, and we realize that Ernest Holmes had a whole different, he had a whole different set of things to change. And that just helps me think about, you know, where he came from and who he was and what his time was, and that we can honor him and then realize that there's so much more that we can create around unity and oneness. So I just thought it was interesting.